I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Amy Shinerman, author of the two-volume new work, The Talmud of Relationships. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, plus our young Shin Shin Yot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of lights and latkes to everyone. Today is the seventh day of Chanukah, which makes tonight the eighth and final night of this wintertime festival of candles and dreidels. It's a time of year that produces lots of lovely family memories and can make you a bit dreamy, looking at the flickering candles, remembering childhood experiences of menorahs and gelt and warmth. So, in a period of the year filled with emotional connections and nostalgic associations, what are you dreaming about in this season of the longest nights? You know, I've been thinking about dreams recently, in part because we've been discussing them in two of my classes, Zohar, the Crown of Kabbalah, a Jewish mysticism course I have taught for many years, and the Genesis Project, a second class for which I have the privilege of being the instructor. In Zohar, the greatest work of Jewish mysticism, dreams are considered to be a small part prophecy, a kind of gift from God to help us dimly see the future. That is, our dreams give us a window into God's intentions in this world. It's a tantalizing idea that our Creator gives us glimpses of some things that are to come, but does so in a dreamy way, if you will. In my Genesis Project class, the texts we've explored go from one dreamer to another, starting with Jacob's dream of the stairway to heaven, then his second dreamlike sequence 20 years later when he wrestles an angel and becomes Israel. And after Jacob, we go to his son from one dreamer to another, the true Bala Chalamot, the dream master himself, Joseph, whose story is always read at this time of year. Joseph has dreams of glory in his youth and later becomes the professional dream interpreter for Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Yet frankly, Joseph never stops dreaming of reuniting his family. Joseph's dreams and his interpretations of others' dreams deeply influence not only the book of Genesis, but the early history of the nation of Israel. There are many other dreamers in the Bible and in Jewish history, but none of them really rises quite to the level of Joseph until Theodor Herzl dreams the modern Jewish state of Israel into existence, in part by his own will and vision. The importance of dreams, visions of what the future can be, are central to the Jewish character always. The great author Israel Zangwill wrote a novel called Dreamers of the Ghetto, and whether we were in the ghetto, or Melach, or Judenstrasse, or a Lower East Side tenement, or a kibbutz in Emek Yisrael, we Jews always dreamed of a better world and a better life. It is no wonder that a Viennese Jew, Sigmund Freud, wrote on the interpretation of dreams. For some Jews, like Theodor Herzl, that dream became the modern nation of Israel, a land where Jews no longer were subject to the whims and persecutions of a non-Jewish state. For other Jews, that dream was to rise from poverty and prejudice to success and acceptance in a free country like America. Those dreams, more or less, came true for most Jews. But dreams are different in every generation and for each person. What are your dreams in this season of Hanukkah, of flickering lights and impossible hopes celebrated? Whatever those dreams are, we pray that at this unique time of year when we remember miracles of long ago, we pray that your dreams are blessed with the promise of achievement and favor, as were those of our own ancestors, in even darker times than these. On a lighter theme, there's a new Queen movie out in theaters now called Bohemian Rhapsody, named after one of the 70s rock band's biggest hits, which was also a unique, iconic musical composition of the time. The wonderful Jewish group, an a cappella group, 613, has a spectacular new parody of Bohemian Rhapsody out for this Hanukkah, 5779. It's called Bohemian Hanukkah. It is so good that, like the original did for radio stations 40 years ago, it forces us to violate our own two Jewish rules on the length of the songs we play. And we have to play the whole darn thing. Here it is, performed a cappella with all instruments created vocally, Bohemian Hanukkah from 613 for the last night of Hanukkah tonight.
Is this the eighth night? We light with family, recall with great pride our escape from great tyranny. Kindle the lights, remember the
Maccabees know what really matters. Thanks to God, our people are free.
That was the thoroughly stunning Bohemian Hanukkah from 613. I really love the part that goes, "More latkes, no, more sufganiyot." They can really rock out just using their voices. A new Hanukkah miracle. Our guest this morning is a friend, Rabbi Amy Shinerman, an outstanding teacher of contemporary Talmud who has two new books out called The Talmud of Relationships. Find out how she makes this great work accessible, relevant, and fresh when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome our guest this morning. Rabbi Amy Shinerman is the author of the new book, The Talmud of Relationships, Volume 1, God, Self, and Family. She is an expert on Talmud and a wonderful teacher and author. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So a lot of us rabbis really like Talmud, even though we're not Orthodox, but it is far from the most popular subject of study. What led you to focus on Talmud in a kind of non-normative Jewish world?
A very long time ago, I experienced a nugget of Talmud learning that stuck with me for years and years. Do you want to hear the story?
We do.
Okay. I was a high schooler participating in youth group activities, and we were at a retreat at Eisner Camp. And during that retreat, it was just before Pesach, they brought in a couple of rabbinical students to teach us. And the group that I was with, the rabbinical student brought us a short passage from Talmud. If you're talking in terms of English, it was a paragraph, nothing more than that. And on the first read, I didn't understand a single word of it. I had no idea what it was talking about. But as he explained it and as we started talking, he peeled off layer after layer, and this passage touched on so many different layers of life and so many issues that we all face that an hour and a half later, our conversation was going strong in this group, and we were supposed to stop, and we were begging him to keep going.
Wow.
And after that session, I naively, or maybe you want to say foolishly, went up to him and asked, "Where is this from?" And he said, "This is from the Talmud," which, sadly, I had no idea what that was. It hadn't been part of my education.
Wow.
And I said to him, here's the naive part, "Is there more of that?" And he laughed just as you did, and he said, "Yes, there are 20 volumes of it." But as you know, to access it, you need certain education and certain skill sets. And that's been a stumbling block for a lot of people, which is a big reason why I wrote this book, because I think the Talmud belongs to all of us, and it has so much to offer us that I don't want to see people stopped at the door because somebody checks their ID and says, "Well, I'm sorry, your Aramaic is not up to snuff. You can't read this book."
What a wonderful way to begin our discussion. We will return in just a couple of moments with Rabbi Amy Shinerman discussing the Talmud of Relationships and its relevance in today's world when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue based in northwest Tucson, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this winter. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to create a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson. Joy-filled Shabbat services will be this Friday night, December 14th at 6:30 p.m. at the Oro Valley Community Center, 10555 North La Cunada Road. Religious school and adult education academy courses are offered at the Temporary Educational Center on Oracle Road, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services and adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. BeitSimcha, Tucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir. Chag Hanukkah Sameach.
Chag Urim Sameach, Rabbi.
So, Hanukkah in America has become this enormous Jewish holiday. It's maybe the one holiday that non-Jews have heard of besides Pesach. And for Jews, it's become one of the most observed Jewish holidays as well. It used to be a minor festival. It's really not anymore. But historically, it's been important. And it's been important in Israel from the time of the Yishuv, really.
Absolutely. It's an important holiday in Israel. A little bit different than the United States. Obviously, it's a very family-oriented. Everyone comes together, light the Chanukiah. And, you know, just the gifts-wise, that's, I think, the only difference. And obviously, you know, being an American myself, I can understand living in the United States and seeing Christmas and the big, you know, tree and underneath the tree, the gifts. But when I grew up, it was very simple. You got, you know, a few coins, right, and leave us alone.
Hanukkah gelt, and
yes,
you get to eat levivot, latkes.
Yeah, sufganiyot.
Sufganiyot, of course, which are about as healthy as the flu.
But Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes. No, they're better than Dunkin'.
They're better. They're better.
They really are.
They are better.
Hanukkah is important to Israelis, not necessarily for specifically religious, but for historical reasons.
Right, right. It's celebrating independence. That's what it is, actually. You know, being brave and fighting for your own country.
You
That's
know,
what it is against.
This was,
you know,
a Jewish
the
army.
The Greek Empire.
Yeah, the Jewish army that actually won.
Yes, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
Up till the time of Israel's independence, that didn't happen very often.
True, true.
Modin was a small town, really.
Right.
Modin is not a small town anymore.
Right. It's a large town now, yes. A lot of Americans, too. You can hear English in the streets.
That's where the Hashmonai are from.
Right, right. You can actually go and visit the graves. You know?
People go, right? They make
a pilgrimage
to the graves of the Maccabees.
Absolutely.
And when you think about let's say, you know, in Israel, okay, everybody knows all the holidays, right?
Yeah.
But I would say that Hanukkah is probably high among the ones that are observed in Israel.
I agree.
When you are back in Israel for Hanukkah,
yes,
it's a different feeling than here. Is it a...
Well, I would say the same about every holiday. You know, I mean, for us Israelis, one is we go back and we celebrate with our family. You know, most of Israelis living here, their family members don't live here. They live in Israel. So that's one of the joyful thing, to unite with your family. But beside that, what's unique, and I'm generalizing, you know, the United States, but if you live in a city where you don't actually live in a big Jewish community around the synagogue, and you go to synagogue every day, then, you know, many of us live in a regular neighborhood. We don't really know that there's a holiday if we're not looking on our calendar. In Israel, it's around you. You feel it. If you want it or not, you go to a store in Passover, there are sections that you know, are closed. Shabbat, there are buses that you don't have buses. You know, so there are things around
and,
you all the time.
And Hanukkah, everybody's lighting Hanukkah.
Right,
going
right,
to somebody's
right.
house every night.
It's, absolutely. Not only in their homes, but outside as well.
Yeah, it makes it very special. Listen, happy end of Hanukkah, and we'll talk next week.
Happy end of Hanukkah, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I should say happy Hanukkah, happy almost end of Hanukkah. You were recently in Shanghai, where I spent the High Holy Days a couple months ago, and you heard something that bothered you. Would you share that with our audience?
Absolutely. So Shanghai, as you know from your own experience there, has a very rich Jewish history at several different points in time. Most recent of which is World War II, the Holocaust, where thousands and thousands of Jews found refuge there and thousands of lives were saved, largely through the courage of two Asian diplomats, one Chinese and one Japanese,
Correct, right.
Who issued transit visas so that Jews could get out of Germany and Austria, pass through Russia, and come to Shanghai, which was a free port and had no entrance control. So they didn't issue entrance visas for Shanghai because nobody needed one.
Yeah, you just walked off the boat.
But they had to be able to get out.
Right.
So
some from Poland too, I might add.
Okay. So that was the most recent chapter. But there was a much earlier chapter right after the Opium Wars during the reign of Queen Victoria, where Baghdadi Jews basically laid the foundations for modern Shanghai. They built the big hotels, the main shopping street. All this stuff was like five or six main families that all wanted to outshine the Rothschilds.
Right, and that's what became the Bund, which is their gigantic financial center.
More importantly, Nanjing Road, which is the biggest shopping street in China.
Right.
So anyway, we had a guide who gives Jewish heritage tours several times a week to big groups. He's very highly thought of. And he referred to these Baghdadi Jews as Sephardic. And there were a couple of non-Jewish people in our group of 15, which comprised probably people of 10 or 12 different nationalities, but at least one or two non-Jews were among them. And so the guide felt obliged to explain, erroneously in my view, that the Jewish world is divided into two subgroups of Jews, Ashkenazic and Sephardic. And the Ashkenazic Jews come from Germany and Poland and Russia and are white, and the Sephardic Jews come from everywhere else and are brown. Well, I took exception to this because the Baghdadi Jews have no roots in Sfarad, which is Spain. They are not Sephardic. Neither are the Jews in Yemen. Neither are the Jews in Iran. With Jews in North Africa, it gets a little bit more complicated because some Jews have lived in Egypt since the time of the Greeks. They lived on Elephantine Island. They lived in Alexandria. Alexandria had a hugely important Jewish community that was responsible for compiling the Septuagint, the first known translation of the Bible. But Sephardim, in particular, have to be descended from people who once lived in Spain or Portugal. And they are generally not brown, quote unquote. They often look like you. They have, you know, red hair and blue eyes. And I mean, they're
stunningly good looking.
They're Sephardim today in Greece and in Turkey and in Holland, in London, in Rochester, New York, in Seattle.
In Tucson, Arizona.
Who are whiter than we are.
Correct.
And when I challenged him on this, he said, okay, well, it's the difference between those who eat rice and those who eat noodles. Even that's not right. So what I want your listeners to take away from this is that the world is not binary. Not everything is black and white. And when you talk about Jewish communities, you have to talk about at least three. The Sephardim, as I just defined them. The Ashkenazim, as this tour guide defined them correctly. And then the communities of the East, or the right. Oriental Jews, or the Mizrahi. In Hebrew, they're called Edot HaMizrah.
All right, and maybe we can explicate that world a little bit next week, Tom. Thanks so much. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rivka Baumgarten totters into her lawyer's office on a walker. She proclaims to him, "I want a divorce." "A divorce?" asks the shocked lawyer. "You heard me, sonny. A divorce." The lawyer asks, "Mrs. Baumgarten, how old are you?"
90.
"And your husband?" "Irving, 92 years old, next month." "Well," the lawyer asks in disbelief, "how long have you been married?" "Tomorrow, 70 years," says Rivka.
70 years?
"Why a divorce now?" he asks.
"Sonny," answers Rivka, "enough is enough."
That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. And no, I don't really do accents very well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And still Chag Sameach. Happy Hanukkah.
Chag Sameach.
So you guys have been now in America for 5 months, almost, well, pushing more than that now. Mm-hmm. And you've been driving all around here. And we Americans, of course, think we're great drivers, which may or may not be the case. But driving here and driving in Israel are not the same thing. Can you guys talk about that comparatively based on your personal experiences?
So there are some differences. For example, we don't have a light for turning right at all. We have just a different lane. So whenever I see red over here, I just stop.
Even though red light, you can stop and then turn right most of the time.
Yeah. And when I want to turn left and there's green, I automatically just go. And I kind of figured out.
About that, Ron.
Yeah, I should be careful.
That doesn't always work so well.
Right. But I feel like after our first month here, I kind of got used to it.
Now, people in America are, you know, there can be aggressive drivers, but if you've ever driven in Israel... So tell us about that difference, because it's not the same.
Yeah, Israelis are very aggressive drivers. They're really impatient. They can be rude. They can be really just aggressive drivers. And we're used to that. So driving here is like more comfortable because not a lot of people honk you when you stall a little bit.
I was pretty sure when I lived in Israel that the brake and the horn were on the same pedal.
Yes. Some people drive with their hand on the horn. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of, like, if you stall for 1 second on a green light, you'll just hear a bunch of horns
We're in America,
screaming at you.
If somebody honks, it's considered like a major offense.
Yeah, you know, it's really quiet here.
People really don't do it. And if you do it, they look at you like you're off some other planet.
Right.
So you come from a country where people drive either like jet fighter pilots or tank drivers. And now you're in a place where there's a lot more space. There's cars here, plenty of cars, but not like Israel where it's so congested. There's lots more cars per square inch, I think.
Yes, Tel Aviv is one example for a really crowded place. Finding parking there is
impossible.
Really rare.
Just about impossible.
Yes. Yep. Really rare. And a lot of like crowded driving and a lot of stress about it. So I don't like to drive in Tel Aviv. I never drove there, like myself. And here there's so many open spaces. There's a lot of parking spots. And it's just way more comfortable for me.
See, that's in praise of American driving. Who knew that would be on the Two Jewish Radio Show? Well, guys, keep driving safely and make sure that when you see the green and you're turning left, there's no cars coming at you.
Yes, definitely.
Thanks so much. Again, Chag Sameach. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash hits the climax of the Joseph story, which fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. It's always during Hanukkah we read much of the great narrative of Joseph. That seems appropriate, for this is a time on the Jewish calendar when we celebrate receiving miraculous assistance from God. And the concept of grace, chen in Hebrew, is a central theme in Joseph's narrative. The last four weekly portions in Genesis form a unique and beautifully wrought literary work focused on Joseph, with a sub-theme based on his brother Judah, which has been called the first truly modern piece of literature. It's particularly impressive since it was written at least 2,500 years ago. Some would add a millennium or so to that number. Many literary techniques are used that you can find today in the best novels. Foreshadowing, cliffhangers, subplots, elegant wordplay, role reversals, startling surprises, intrigue of all sorts, character growth and failure, and much more. The story of Joseph is better written, richer, and more dramatic than almost all of our best books and movies today. And the Joseph story's long-term implications are far more significant than our contemporary myths, and are clear to us as readers throughout the telling. After all, it is because of Joseph that we will all end up down in Egypt, getting enslaved, liberated, reinvented into the greater people of Israel. But with all the twists and turns, and with the deep historical meaning, the overriding message is that ultimately, as Joseph himself says to his brothers in Vayigash, God has a greater plan. We are just part of it. We can't know the whole. But it and we will ultimately serve a higher purpose. There's something about this story that compels us to examine our assumptions about just how things work in our world. Unpredictable things happen. What we expect is often not what occurs. Fate plays a role. The last can rise to first. Justice may ultimately be done. Only God really knows how it will all go together in the end. So, what's left for us? Well, if we follow both Joseph's example and his words quite a lot, we can strive to repair damaged relationships within our family. We can work hard, help others, seek to prevent disasters from occurring in our lives and theirs. We can quite literally keep the faith, believing in and following God's ways. And if we are given the opportunity, we can forgive those who have hurt us in the past. Great lessons all from our ancestor Joseph this week. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Amy Shinerman, will explain why Talmud has so much to teach us today for our complicated world and how her work makes it available to anyone. Find out much more when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There will be nothing because there is nothing, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has been saying often lately in Israel, telling his supporters that despite many allegations of corruption and four separate police investigations into his conduct, he is absolutely blameless. Following opposition lawmakers' calls for his resignation last week in response to police recommendation that he be indicted once more on charges, including bribery and breach of trust, Netanyahu hit back, tweeting these recommendations were set and leaked before the investigations even began. Well, maybe. He and his allies in the government have gone on the offensive now, blaming law enforcement, blaming the media, blaming the judiciary for conspiring against him. This has proven to be an effective strategy to the bafflement of outsiders, but Israelis have come to accept the inevitability of the latest corruption charges against a high-ranking public official. It happens often there. There are currently four distinct investigations into Prime Minister Netanyahu and his inner circle. Four. Known in Israel's cases 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and 4,000. Except for case 3,000, in which Netanyahu is not a suspect, all of the investigations focus on allegations that the prime minister engaged in quid pro quos to use his influence in exchange for gifts or favors. In cases 2,000 and 4,000, he is alleged to have offered favors to the owners of media outlets in exchange for more positive coverage of him. Last week, police recommended Netanyahu be indicted in case 4,000. They had previously recommended indictments of Bibi in cases 1,000 and 2,000. You got all that? Despite multiple scandals, however, the prime minister's popularity is still high. He retains the political support of his base and a significant chunk of the wider Israeli electorate. According to a poll by Smith Consulting, doesn't sound that Israeli somehow. Anyway, a poll conducted by Smith Consulting in November, Netanyahu's Likud would have won 29 seats if elections were held last month. That's down just one seat from the 30 that Likud now holds in Knesset. Of course, they only have a one-seat majority, but never mind. And 30% of the people polled named Netanyahu the most suitable Israeli prime minister. That may not be that high, but it's twice the level of support for the next highest-rated candidate. According to the Israel Democracy Institute's annual Democracy Index, released this week, 72% of Israelis indicated that they see the government as corrupt. Israelis are very alarmed and worried about the level of corruption, says the Institute's president, Yochanan Plesner. This indicates a lack of trust in the motivations of our public figures. Ironically, the popular view of Israel as a corrupt country is less a reflection of overall corruption than of Israel's successful fight against corruption. Plesner added, the reason why there is a high perception is because we have independent law enforcement that interrogates and indicts politicians. So the activities designed to deal with corruption also increase the perception of corruption. Definitely ironic. High-level corruption cases in recent years have resulted in the convictions of former Israeli President Moshe Katsav, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, and a former Chief Rabbi Yonah Metzger. We'll see if Netanyahu eventually joins their minion in prison. In other news, a devastating fire gutted a synagogue in Cape Town, South Africa last week, destroying 7 Torah scrolls. No one was injured in the blaze at Beit Midrash Morashah, also known as Arthur's Road Shul in Sea Point, Cape Town, South Africa. The cause is under investigation. A handwritten letter by Albert Einstein on religion, his Jewish identity, and search for meaning was sold at auction for nearly $3 million, more than 7 times the sale price a decade ago. Einstein wrote what has been called the God Letter to philosopher Eric Gutkind in 1954. Last week it sold at Christie's for $2,892,500, doubling the estimated sale price. The word God is for me nothing but the expression and product of human weaknesses, Einstein wrote. The Bible, a collection of venerable but still rather primitive legends. For me, the unadulterated Jewish religion is like all other religions, an incarnation of primitive superstition. And the Jewish people to whom I gladly belong and whose mentality I feel proudly anchored, still for me does not have any different kind of dignity from all other peoples. Of course, this is the same Albert Einstein who famously said of his search for the unified field theorem, God doesn't play dice with the universe, and who was offered the first presidency of Israel and expressed shame that he had to decline for family reasons. In any case, back in 2008, Einstein's The God Letter was sold at auction to a private collector for $404,000, now almost $3 million. Not bad appreciation over 10 years, sevenfold. Kind of biblical. And the new season of the Emmy Award-winning show, 8 Emmys for season 1, if you're counting. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is out now on Amazon Prime, and it's great. I'm not sure anything can top the amazing first season of the show, whose stars are past guests of Too Jewish, but it's the best hour of TV on the air today, and you can watch the season straight through, stream it without commercials. Best Jewish show ever, I think. Funny, touching, and brilliant. Still on the TV front, there's another wonderful Jewish show from show-running great Chuck Lorre of The Big Bang Theory, 2.5 Men, and Dharma and Greg. It stars two old Jewish actors, Alan Arkin and Michael Douglas, and it's called The Kaminsky Method. It's also very funny, but slower paced than Mrs. Maisel. Well, so is every other show on TV, but very much about death, aging, and yet infused with an incredibly Jewish pathos. And it's funny.
Asmimbi.
She's a terrific kid. I don't know how I'd run that school without her.
Well, yeah, our mother did a wonderful job raising her.
Oh, forget I raised her too, Norman.
Does she know that?
You're getting older. You don't want to be reminded.
Reminded of what?
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to make me say it?
Come on, say it.
Dad.
Wrong. Right. That is so wrong.
I'm walking away from you.
Baby, hold on. Norman, I need my coat.
I'm sorry. Can I buy you a new coat?
That one's on Netflix and worth making the time to watch, if only to see Alan Arkin and Michael Douglas work together. They are fantastic. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Amy Scheinerman, who's an expert on Talmud and has, I said this incorrectly earlier, so part of the Talmud is correcting anything that anybody ever gets wrong. And I got this wrong.
And things that they don't get wrong, but you disagree with.
That's true, too.
For your own very good reason.
Absolutely. She has two volumes out. The first is A Talmud of Relationships, Volume 1, God, Self, and Family. The second is A Talmud of Relationships, Volume 2, The Jewish Community and Beyond. Welcome back to Two Jewish.
Thank you.
We started by discussing why you got interested in Talmud study and the fact that it isn't really taught quite frequently in, and Orthodox Jews, I think, all know the Talmud exists, and many anybody who's studying seriously certainly studies Talmud. Why do you think it has become such an afterthought for particularly Reform Jews, but conservative Jews as well?
I would imagine that that's because it seems esoteric, it seems difficult to grapple with, and I think because it also got a very bad rap for in the liberal community for several reasons. One is because Judaism was perceived to be a very legalistic tradition, and I can talk about that a little more, and the Talmud was perceived to be the source of that. And
the whole notion of pilpul, that everything was, you know, splitting hairs.
Yes, and that it's all about permitted or forbidden.
But it's not really that.
I don't think so. I think that legalism, or the notion that the nature of Talmud is legalistic, that legalism is an idiom of Jewish religiosity. We talk about mitzvah and obligations, and those are expressed in legal terms, but I think that has been largely misunderstood and unfortunately understood by a lot of people with a great deal of authority. I would propose that halakha is process and not product, which is to say that halakha is about the process of making a Jewish decision, grappling with important questions and hard questions, and trying to arrive at a decision about how to live your life. And you do that via a process of discussion and debate, where you accept that there will be disagreement, you accept there will be multiple opinions, but always keeping your discussion civil and checking your intentions to make sure that it's a machloket l'shem shamayim, that it's a conversation for the sake of heaven, not for the sake of your ego or because you're having an intellectual competition with the people in the room. And the result of that kind of process is that we don't always arrive at the same answer, and in fact, we don't always arrive at an answer. And we can at times agree to disagree. But it is always crucial to consider many viewpoints. And all of that is a very apt description of the Talmud. It does not always arrive at a decision. Minority opinions are always mentioned and always considered with respect. You might be familiar with Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardozo.
Of course.
Yes?
Yes.
He wrote a fascinating article called The Future and Spirit of Halakha back in 2010, I believe. It was published in Conversations. And he writes that the two main law codes that people are familiar with, Joseph Carroll's Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, that these are by their very nature un-Jewish and may well be the worst thing that ever happened to Judaism. Because they stifle the conversation, and they erase minority opinions, and they tell us that the discussion and the debate and the disagreement are no longer acceptable. All we want is the bottom line, and they have decided what the bottom line is. And so that beautiful sense of process, that beautiful way of going about discussing, debating, and also harmonizing different opinions or accepting differences of opinion, that all of that gets pushed aside in favor of a rule book.
You know, it's
a rigid rule book.
In a period in which diversity of opinion has come in our country to mean hostility, and sometimes even violence. The Talmud presents diversity of opinion as an essential element. I mean, there's not a page in which disagreement isn't replete in the Talmud, that isn't replete with division.
And I think that's because if you are A, thinking, and B, care, how could it ever be otherwise?
Because you're going to care and you're going to be passionate, but that doesn't mean you're going to attack physically the person you disagree. You're going to attack their arguments, you're going to differ. It does sometimes cross the line a little bit. There is some personal aspersions are cast at times, that's for sure.
Yeah, personal animus is a part of us, but it's also something that we should keep in check.
And maybe channel into the discussion of the issues, as the Talmud does in this elaborate way. I had a Talmud professor, Mordechai Finley, a long time ago, who called the Talmud the Jewish people's love poem to God. I've also heard it called something like the Congressional Record, just a long record of a whole bunch of stuff and a whole lot of argument. Those are very different ways of looking at the same text. Where would you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I like that colorful and poetic way to put it. I think that if you look at it from an historical and academic perspective, the latter way, the Congressional Record, is not entirely accurate, because it's very clear, scholars tell us, that there was very much an editing and redacting process that went into it. So we are hearing what went on over a long period of time, but not merely as a congressional record. I would say that Talmud is an extended, multi-generational exploration and conversation of the meaning of covenant with God in the context of community. And when we study here in the 21st century, or any other, we're invited into that conversation, because indeed it was meant to be an ongoing conversation. It wasn't meant to close avenues of communication, but open them up.
Historically, in traditional Judaism, women were, this is gently put, not encouraged to study Talmud. There are examples that really prove the rule, like Bathsheba Singer's, you know, Yentl the Yeshiva Boy. That restriction has changed dramatically in recent eras. In your focus on Talmud and your own scholarly work, do you still find biases that you must overcome?
I live so much in the liberal or progressive Jewish world that I'm not faced with those kind of biases on a regular basis. With respect to the various bigotries and prejudices that people hold against women and a host of others, the world is changing, though I will say, albeit much too slowly for my taste. If I stand back, if I pull myself back and look at the bigger picture, I'm pretty fortunate to live in a generation that's afforded me the opportunity to learn and teach and write. Those are all blessings, and I'm pretty grateful for them.
And I might...
Those who choose to hold on to their outmoded ideas about women, quite frankly, are the losers. But I think they're also an ever-shrinking number. I put out a blog called 10 Minutes of Talmud. It's up on the web, but I also email it to people who ask me to. And I do that as regularly as I can. And one of the people that I hear back from all the time who says, I love your teachings and I am teaching them, is an Orthodox rabbi.
That's fantastic. I should say.
And I'm not sure you'd call him modern Orthodox. I'm not certain.
Huh. A final question. I feel like we've gone a long time. You title this The Talmud of Relationships. What do you think the ideal relationships are that are established in the Talmud?
It's not so much that I can give you an example of what the ideal relationship looks like, since we're all humans and none of us are ideal, but I would say this also, that Judaism has goals to strive for, but we're not really interested in this notion of perfection, because we know it doesn't exist. We're interested in the notion of improvement. You go into Rosh Hashanah every year not so that you can make yourself perfect in the coming year, just so you can make yourself better than you were in the last. So the ideal relationship is not a certain relationship, but something that is grounded, I think, in human dignity. We endlessly quote that phrase we love so much from the Torah, that we are created B'Tselem Elohim. And that is writ large in the minds of so many people. But I worry about it, because I think to say that we are created B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God or on the model of God is a two-edged sword, and we need to be careful of it. So on the one edge, we can use that phrase to claim massive and dangerous entitlement for human beings. After all, we are the very model of God. And look what we're doing. We're ravaging the planet that's our home because of our own sense of importance and entitlement. But on the other hand, the other edge, if I say that I am created B'Tselem Elohim, that I myself am the very image of God, I'm B'Tselem Elohim, then I must recognize that you are too, and indeed everybody is. And this teaches me to respect the dignity of each and every person I encounter, because to peer into the face of any human being is to behold the face of God. And that's a really powerful idea for me, especially when the face of God loses his or her temper and yells at me, or asks me for money on the street, or holds political ideas that I find repugnant. I still am looking at something that is modeled on God. And it's often very challenging. But as I understand the Talmud, we often miss the mark. But what we're supposed to aim for is recognize the human dignity that's inherent in every person and then adjust our behavior. I need to adjust my behavior accordingly.
It's a great
teaching. And that's
great teaching.
Really helpful to me.
Yeah, a great teaching and a great lesson. I want to thank Rabbi Amy Shinerman for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. Her books, The Talmud of Relationships, Volume 1 and 2, are available, of course, at Amazon, where everything in the world, more or less, is available. First one, God, Self, and Family. The second one, The Jewish Community and Beyond. Amy, where can people go to find out more about you as well?
You can go to my website. If you just type my name into Google, it'll pop right up. I also have a blog for Torah commentaries and a blog for Talmud, and you're welcome to those too. And it's very easy to get in touch with me. And I wrote these books for two reasons. One, the reasons we've said here to share all of this, and the other is because I do love to teach, and I love to teach and share face-to-face. So I've been very fortunate in the last few years to visit congregations all over the country and rabbinic groups also, and even abroad, to come and teach. So that is something I dearly, dearly love to do, because then I get to meet people.
Absolutely, and she's great at it. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Tammy Rossman Benjamin, co-founder of the Amcha organization that combats anti-Israel BDS and anti-Semitism on college campuses. They have a new initiative responding to the latest evil trick of the BDS movement, trying to stop colleges from allowing students to go on year abroad programs to Israel. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, top 10 in America for Jewish programs. Our playout this morning for the last night of Hanukkah is from the Maccabees, past guests of Too Jewish, a medley of all kinds of different musical interpretations from many eras, each singing I Have a Little Dreidel. My friends, may you have a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a Chag Urim Sameach, a happy conclusion to the holiday of Hanukkah with the eighth night tonight, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
I have a little dreidel, I made it out of clay, and when it's dry and ready, Oh, dreidel, I shall play. Oh, dreidel, 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 I made it out of clay. And when it's dry and ready, oh, dreidel, I shall play.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.